Let me begin with a scenario for you. Imagine you are at a coffee shop with some friends, and one of those persons next to you turns to you and says this, "You know, you're a religious person. You go to church, don't you? Are you one of those evangelicals? And by the way, do you believe that abortion is wrong?" What's your response? Everyone's religious. See the challenge. What are the words that we speak that come out of our mouths? What if I say, "God hates abortion and he's killing innocent babies"? Now, this applies if you're middle school or high school. You could be sitting at a lunch counter and table at school and going, does this conversation ever come up or the potential for it? See, those two questions, what about your faith? And second, what about this social issue? Realize those two questions have the potential to be a landmine these days. See, those questions, those issues create intense reactions even in our culture. We got to realize that culture has changed, and I don't think many Christians, too many, don't realize it. It's different than it was 25 years ago. And many people have preconceived ideas about those who claim to have a faith. And for a growing set of people, if they know that we have a faith, we're considered narrow-minded, we're considered intolerant, and if you're a man, it means that you hate women if you're opposed to abortion. But even the concept of God has changed. See, when we say that God hates abortion, God says it's murder. What do you think they think about God at that moment? Now, some of us can respond and maybe this, "I don't care what they think. I'm just going to stand up for what's true." But see, in the eyes of the world concerning abortion, what is the real issue for them? It's this: choice. It's the right to choose. And what do you call people who eliminate other persons' right to choose? What do you call people who deny the right to be happy? You call them dictators, intolerant, oppressors. And what do you call a God who doesn't give you choice? Or doesn't want to give you happiness? You call him a dictator, oppressive, not a very nice nor fair God. See, the question, would we be happy using words like that for God? When was the last time that you sang a song that went something like, "Oh, most wonderful dictator, we marvel at your tyranny and we bow ourselves before your oppression"? That doesn't fit with our worship, does it? Here's what we got to figure out. This culture has a set of values and a set of assumptions that we must understand. Why? The more we know how they think, the greater ability for us to be prepared to give a defense for the hope that is within us because of Jesus. Let me put a theme verse. This is a key verse for us as we move forward in this series. 1 Peter chapter 3, we started digging in it last week. Look at verse 15. "But in your hearts, honor Christ the Lord as holy. Always be prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you. Yet do it with gentleness and respect." Being prepared. But here's the reality. Many people can't defend their faith even outside the home. And matter of fact, I would say this: many parents can't defend their faith to their children. If you're new, we weren't here last week. We jumped in and started the series, Big Objections. The idea is, what are holding people back from walking or even considering Christ? See, I would believe, but, and you fill in that blank. I want to put some on the screen just to remind you some of the things that people believe that hold them back and go, they look at us and go, I don't like you. See, everyone knows that the Bible is full of errors and can't be trusted. And Christians and churches are so hung up on sex, why should they care who and how I love? But your God allows so much evil and suffering in this world. Why would I want that kind of God? I would believe, but Christians are such hypocrites. They think their way is the only way. And how can a loving God send people to hell? I think I'm a good person, and I don't deserve hell. 1 Peter 3:15, it needs to be understood. But most of all, it needs to be applied. Now, here's where, beginning of the sermon here, I got to add to some foundational issues from last week. Understand, reminder, he wrote this to a group of churches, but he didn't just write it to pastors and elders. It was to everybody within those churches. They were to read it. So when we come to verse 15, be prepared to give an answer. That word there, it's apologetic built in there. For the reason, that word is logic. A logical reason for the hope that we have because of Jesus Christ. We are to be people of hope. And it says that, it implies that people would see that in us and they would begin to ask and we would be ready to defend and give a reason to why we have that hope. So let me give you some more reminders this morning. This is really a continuation from last week. The first one, if you're following along in the sermon outline, I said it this way. Giving a reason for our hope is not about winning an argument. Rather, it is about unleashing the power of the gospel. To make a defense, the goal is not to debate. Matter of fact, I would say this. Some of you know Rabbi Zacharias, that name, Rabbi Zacharias. None of us will ever be him. I'm pretty confident of that. Maybe you are, and you're a closet person, then apologetic, okay? But I know myself, I will never be him. But see, it still calls us to make a defense in such a way that the gospel can work. It's about the Holy Spirit using us to remove confusion, open the eyes of people so that as they look at Jesus, they go, I wonder. It's about breaking down barriers, not winning an argument. And if we love to get in debate, we go off in the wrong direction. And I have to admit this, I love to debate. There's been some times where I've debated people and I feel guilty afterward. But that phrase, verse 15, I don't know if you caught that. Do it with gentleness and respect. Critical in giving a defense. So recognize this is about communicating with all kinds of people. It could be hardcore antagonists to us as our inner faith. But my hunch is, for the most part, that will be the exception rather than the rule. But oftentimes, this needs to be applied to people who fundamentally are just ignorant about God, about Jesus. So when you think of preparing to give a defense, it's about your hairdresser, my hairdresser, our next door neighbors, our friends, our family, our coworkers. But the ultimate goal is not to win an argument, it's helping them meet Jesus. For them to know Jesus and the Father and His incredible love. Now from last week, I just want to remind you from last week, here's the temptation for us. Let's lie low. Just avoid the world out there. Or let's huddle up and create a fort of Christians, and we're just going to stay away from the world. But here's the dilemma. Matthew 28, the Great Commission to go make disciples. That includes people who are opposing our faith. And it includes those who are confused about truth. Matter of fact, 1 Peter 3:15 is an extension of the Great Commission. Recognize that. But here's another reminder, number two here. Giving a defense is not just an intellectual exercise. Apologetics is not just an intellectual thing only. It's where we learn, if when they say this, we say this. That's what I think we think it is at times. We got to catch this. It is a spiritual reality. And realize that we're engaged in a spiritual battle, not just an intellectual battle. It is a battle of the heart. Let me show you a passage, 2 Corinthians chapter 10. Look at this, verse 3. For though we live in the world, we do not wage war as the world does. The weapons as we fight with are not the weapons of the world. On the contrary, they have divine power to demolish strongholds. We demolish arguments and every pretension that sets itself up against the knowledge of God. And we take captive every thought to make it obedient to Christ. And we will be ready to punish every act of disobedience once your obedience is complete. Now, I want to read you from the Message. The Message is a much more of a flowery paraphrase version, but it points out to some things. I like the way it says it. Look at what it says there. The world is unprincipled. It's a dog-eat-dog out there. The world doesn't fight fair. But we don't live or fight our battles that way. We never have and never will. The tools of our trade aren't for marketing or manipulation, but they are for demolishing that entirely, massively corrupt culture. We use our powerful God tools for smashing warped philosophies, tearing down barriers erected against the truth of God, fitting every loose thought and emotion and impulse into the structure of life shaped by Christ. Our tools are ready at hand for clearing the ground of every obstruction and building lives of obedience into maturity. This is a war, not guns, not bullets, not even necessarily words. See, we don't wage war like the world does. This is in the spiritual realm. And Paul tells us that we have spiritual power to demolish strongholds and push back and make an impact on their beliefs. Now, I don't know if you caught something at the end of this, but there is a condition as we demolish strongholds and every false pretension that sets itself up against the knowledge of God. We are to do something first. We are to take captive every thought. Not their thoughts. It's not referring to their thoughts. This is our thoughts that comes in our minds. We are to make our thoughts obedient to Christ. Listen to the way the Message said it. Fitting every loose thought and emotion and impulse into the structure of life shaped by Christ. Why? So that when we respond, it stays a spiritual battle. Not a personal battle, not a battle of even just words. See, this is more than just an intellectual battle pushing back. See, it is a need for our minds and our attitudes and our tongues to be shaped by Christ. A spiritual battle and an intellectual battle, they're not the same thing. Is the mind crucial? Yes, and we'll see that even here today. But it's more than just the right intellectual answer. It's about understanding this thing called the heart. It's about understanding this thing that we, you and I, have emotions and that we've been through experiences. And it's the understanding that there are things happening in their minds and their hearts and their emotions that they're going through. See, this really leads to number three, a critical point here. Giving a defense and an answer is also about a compassionate understanding of the other person. You know, you're at a job or school, at some kind of gathering, and someone makes a derogatory statement like this: those pro-life people, they're women haters. And we respond, if I responded with an edge, I'm one of those people. And I don't think God likes killing babies. Now, some of us, we hear that we're just going to stand for the truth. We're going to defend God, and that's going to be my witness. But here's where I got to push it a bit. If I were to give comments with an edge like that, those thoughts would not have been taken captive by Christ. Now, let me go back to someone asking you a question concerning abortion. If you knew that person that asked, what did you think? If you knew that that person was raped and had gotten pregnant because of that rape, would it change the way you responded? Would it change the tone, the way we responded? Do you catch the point? It doesn't change our conviction. It needs often to start with compassion. So realize that many of the beliefs that people hold out there are deeply tied to what is going on, not just in the intellectual level, but in the emotional level. Many times it goes beyond just reason and logic and intellect. It is in the emotional world of the person. And they have been convinced of certain values even because other people or friends or family have gone through emotional pain. Now, some people think that all Christians are hypocrites, but what if you know that a parent had been abused by a clergyman or a priest at some church? See, often there is a story behind the attitude and that we know nothing about. It goes beyond reason, folks, and logic and intellect. The believing is based many times on their experiences. Is it still a flawed belief? The answer is yes, it is. See, be prepared to make a defense includes the emotional world of people. You know, I've said this before. You know, my daughter is married to a Hispanic. Actually, technically, Josh is half, his mom is full. And Josh, though, looks Hispanic, if you look at a picture of him. And my daughter is literally allergic to the sun, okay? Which means she doesn't tan. And the kids are all light-skinned. And people, they'll go through lines, and they've experienced this, and my daughter's experienced it. They look at her and go, they can't be Josh's kids. And they made comments about the two of them together. See, that could actually impact my understanding of injustice and racism. Now, they handle it well. But see, it really leads to another point, and this is where we got to go a little farther here and begin to apply it. How do we do this? And it's so key. Number four here for your notes. Apologetics is not about throwing a quick response at other people's beliefs. Rather, it's about learning to ask questions and to know what is culturally assumed and emotionally embraced. And this is where gentleness and respect and loving your neighbor come into play. See, Jesus understood his audience when he engaged them. Jesus was a master of asking questions and understanding the things behind the scenes. Matter of fact, I don't know if you realize this, in the Gospels, he asked over 150 questions, and when you look at his questions, you go, this guy was brilliant, as we know. See, we need to recognize the power of questions, and we need to listen in such a way that it gives us clues how to respond and prepare to defend our faith. Questions. I came across an interesting quote. Someone once asked a rabbi, "Rabbi, why do you always answer a question with a question?" To which he replied, "Why shouldn't I answer a question with a question?" I like that. Let me give you an example. Matthew chapter 22. To be prepared, and folks, this is a skill we need to learn. You know, I've given us a grid, head, heart, hands. What do we need to learn to prepare, be prepared? What is the attitude of our heart, the motives? But then there's this hands thing, and it really is about skill. And look at Matthew chapter 22, verse 15. And the Pharisees went and plotted how to entangle him in his words. And they sent their disciples to him along with the Herodians, saying, "Teacher, we know that you are true and teach the way of God truthfully. And you do not care about anyone's opinion, for you are not swayed by appearances. Tell us then, what do you think? Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not?" Now they start with a question, okay? But Jesus, aware of the malice. Now he had an experience with this group already. Said, "Why put me to the test, you hypocrites? Show me the coin for the tax." And they brought him a denarius. And Jesus said to them, "Whose likeness and inscription is this?" Another question. And they said, "Caesar's." Then he said to them, "Therefore render to Caesar the things that we are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God." And when they heard it, they marveled, and they left him and went away. He could have said, "Jesus, do you pay taxes?" He could have said yes or no. He didn't answer that way. He wanted to take it farther. It wasn't a simple answer. Jesus knew that it was a cultural trap. Jesus understood that the Jews knew that they were God's chosen people. They were under the oppression of the army, Roman army, and the army was financed by their taxes. And if you're paying taxes, the assumption back then is that you didn't have any integrity as a Jew. Jesus understood that. If you don't pay, they would go run tell the Romans, trying to arrest him. You see the trap that, with questions, they were actually trying to put him into a trap. But catch this, these people were asking questions, and the questions were based on their values and their assumptions. And you notice how he answered. He was aware of their motives. Give to Caesar what's Caesar's, pay taxes, give to God which is God's. Do you see why he didn't just say yes or no? He wanted the rest of the audience, even that was listening to exchange, to go farther, to push them. Jesus was acutely aware of the cultural values and their belief system. Now, in parenting, I've said this a lot. We can talk at our kids, or we can talk with our kids. Two different forms of parenting. And do you know that you can't talk with your children unless you learn to ask the right questions? They will hear it as at them if you can't figure out what questions to ask. The right questions. Discern the values, what they believe, the assumptions, things behind the scenes. Think of the abortion debate again. I'm using this today. They throw a verbal dart at you. You obviously hate women and want to take their rights away. And if I would respond by just raising my voice, "I believe that abortion is murder and God hates it," that is speaking at them. At them. That's not the goal. Now here's what we could literally do. You reply with a question. So when they ask, "Is abortion wrong?" you start with a question. "Can I ask you something? Could you just please answer just one question for me? When is it okay to kill an innocent person?" And what will most people say to that question? No. Never. But think about that belief about abortion. You could go on to say something like this, "But what if that in that womb that is life? Then what gives anyone, a question, what gives anyone the right to end it?" But you can acknowledge what if that thing in there isn't life, then it shouldn't be protected. See, here's the deal. If we can ask questions with gentleness and respect so that they feel dissonance, emotional conflict, it's chipping at their heart. Yes, in the mind, that logically, there's a dilemma too, but it goes after their heart as well. Now, here's where you got to put some thinking caps on here. I'm going to go a little heavier here on you. And some of you have been daydreaming back here, so wake up back there, okay? Wake up, okay? In philosophy and ethics, we can set up what's called a faulty dilemma. I don't know if any of you heard that term. A faulty dilemma is when you intentionally limit the options. You phrase the question in a certain way, so it doesn't matter which option you choose, it's always wrong. And at times the world does this toward us. But at times we need to set questions up so it raises a counterpoint to what they believe. A faulty dilemma is an example. Anybody want to be used as an example? Scott. You're leaving. Scott, does your mother know that you are stupid? Yep. See, if they say no, first of all, they're admitting they're stupid, and second, that their mother's ignorant. If they don't answer, they're saying they're stupid. You catch the dilemma there. And the culture is doing this to believers, by the way. We need to understand it. But we must learn the art and the skill of asking questions that are pushing their assumptions, their values, what they understand about truth. The truth issue is a critical issue, and we must begin to develop a skill to use it. So let me even go deeper concerning abortion and many of their objections. So you got to get that second thinking cap and put this one on as well. It centers again on this issue of truth. When we are accused by the world that we have a corner on truth, that becomes a reason for their rejection. They don't like that we're setting the standard for truth and that we say that. And people reject what we believe because of their definitions and assumptions about truth. So here's where we need to dig. The issues of truth deeply intersects with the call to make a defense, to be prepared, the apologetic, and the logic. And this fits in the ethics world, the philosophy world, the theological world, the biblical world. See, this issue sets a foundation, and it intersects how we're going to deal with many of these topics as we look ahead. There's a couple of questions we must use and understand and be ready to give a defense. And our children, folks, if you're a parent, as they grow up and get to be teenagers, they need to understand this issue. So going deep here, being prepared about truth, there's this critical question, I'll put it on the screen. Who gets the right to decide what is morally good and what is morally evil? And at the heart, this is a dilemma, actually for all of us. See, there's a question, to go push it farther, there's a question that flows from this question. And here it is morality is just, it's the right and wrongness of something, okay? Is morality objective or subjective? Is truth fixed or is it fluid? Can it change? Objective morality, there's a truth that's always been true. It's right has always been right. There's an evil that always has been evil. Right and wrong are permanent, but when you get to subjective morality of what's right and wrong, what is good or bad is not locked in time. It's fluid. It changes. It's based on the culture and the circumstances. And if you listen closely, what is rooted in the culture is often determined by two questions. Two questions, and this is their pathway to determine what is morally right and what is morally wrong. Let me put them on the screen. What is the most loving thing to do, and what is the most reasonable thing to do? Now, they maybe can't articulate these questions, but it is built into their DNA. See, we must understand that the average person on the street who does not care about God and the Scriptures, in their mind, they're still defaulting to this idea of what is the most loving thing to do. For example, in the abortion area, it's more loving. Don't you know it's more loving to not bring a crack baby into this world? Of course you should abort that child. Because the mom has a right, it's unloving, so otherwise the mom won't be happy. It's more loving not to bring a baby into the world if there's a syndrome, a Down syndrome. Of course you don't want that. That's not loving. It's going to be hard for mom, for the parents. They won't be happy. That's not loving. What's the reasonable thing when they go down that path? Look at the costs of this child. It's going to be on a life support for so long, and we don't know if it's going to live or die. Look at the cost to the culture. Isn't it more reasonable that we would just not have that baby? See, deep down, that's their method of determining what is morally good and morally evil. The big problem, though, with that, and this is where you got to be able to articulate this, who decides what's loving? Who gets the right to decide what's reasonable? You see their dilemma? There's a problem there. You understand, folks, this is why there's a war in the Supreme Court at the bottom line. Because we've set the Supreme Court up as the arbitrator for what is morally right and what's evil. It's just the system that we're in. Now, do they always do it? The answer is no. But as a person who follows Christ, let me put something else on the screen for you, the next phrase. We need to understand this. What a follower of Christ must believe is we believe that there is a transcendent and prescriptive truth, meaning that truth does not start with us asking the question. It starts from outside of humanity. It starts from God. The transcendent God determines truth, and he prescribed it. He gave it. He gave it to us. Now, they don't like that. Matter of fact, a lot of them have never even heard that, though. That there's this subjective or objective truth. And you see, prescriptive is objective truth. See, even God, we believe this. God defines love. He defines evil. He sets the structures. God defines what is fair. So people don't like a God when their definition of fair doesn't match up with God's definition of fair. Or you change the definition of God. That happens too. Then the Bible becomes fluid. Today is different than it was 2,000 years ago when Paul wrote it. Obviously, it's different today. We know differently. We know differently. Truth is fluid. So realize the world's values. They believe that everyone has the right to decide what is right for them. And we hear that everybody has the right to determine our own destiny and decide what's right and wrong for them. And yet, it's totally inconsistent, rationally. But if you ask, does everybody have the right to decide what's true? Is that objective or subjective? You go, it's not objective, it's subjective. Look at a verse. There's nothing new under the sun when it comes to the Scriptures. Judges 21, I've had this up on the screen before. In those days, there was no king of Israel. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes. That's our culture. But understand this, that's the way we're born. Kids were working on depravity on Wednesday night. The Bible understands that people default to a position naturally. It's a part of our flesh, our sin nature, our depravity. that the culture starts with, you can determine your own destiny and your rights. And don't let anybody take that away from you. No one can claim a right to your body. Matter of fact, our culture celebrates that idea. You have the right. That's the word autonomy. I've been trying to introduce this over the years. Autonomy is independence, and I get the right to decide what's right for me. We see it in our lives, our own lives, folks, as well. And we have this uncanny ability, I want to decide what's fair. I think of my kids growing up, mom and dad, that's not fair. Anybody, your kids ever, you got kids, your kids didn't say that? It's not fair. Let me go back to the abortion example. Their platform, just so you catch this, what is their highest value? It's the right to choose. The right to decide what I do with my body, that is at the root autonomy. And that is subjective truth. Now here's where, as I was digging this week, I bumped into an issue that makes it actually messier for us. If you were to go back to the mid-century, 20th century, the classical atheists and the secular people, they were actually reluctant to agree with any kind of objective moral law. Their morals, they could not put that on it in any way. Why? It's because they knew if there was an objective moral law, there was an easy step to a place where who is the moral lawgiver? And so they fought for no objective truth. And they knew that it was a problem. See, they understood it. And someone would ask him, you know, is it wrong to treat a person as subhuman because he has darker skin? Or is it wrong to torture babies? They would actually have to respond like this. The answer would be, no, or well, it depends, and I prefer not to do those things, but how can I judge other people? That was where some of the intellectual people were in the mid-20th century. So that phrase, I can judge what another person does and believes, now that's still rooted in our culture, and it's a high value, but it's not consistent like it was before. Here's the deal. It's become messier. Folks, there's been a switch. There's what's called the new school of atheists and secularists. And the new atheists say like this, we don't need God to be good. Matter of fact, we don't need a moral law that's given by God, so they've rejected it. They don't want prescriptive truth. And they point to their own lives, and they compare it to the Christians that have been hypocrites and lived their lives through hypocrisy, and they go, look it. I'm proving to you that I can be more moral than those people who claim an objective and who believe in God. They use experience to actually do that. But the change is that now they are qualifying it and they are acknowledging that there is objective truth to some degree. So there's certain behaviors like truth-telling, kindness, tolerance that are objectively good. And there are others like rape, murder, racism are wrong. So now morality is not just quite personal preference. This is more in the academic system. It hasn't really it's starting to filter down, okay, into the world. But they say that the laws are real and true and binding no matter what people think about them or whether one chooses to follow them. Now, where did these moral laws, these objective truths come from? And here's what they say. Evolution. Evolution. This is what Dawkins believes. They're beginning to say that the laws that are objective have been percolating through evolution and they're coming out. Now there's certain laws that are objective and consistent. See, these are the new atheists now. Why did they do this? Because they knew that logic that moves towards subjective truth doesn't work. They were getting backed into corners all the time. So where did objective truths come from? Evolution. Morality has been percolating and passed down through the evolutionary process. Here's where the power of questions come into play again. I know this is heady stuff for some of you, but I want to, and these aren't mine, I didn't come up with these, understand this. I'm not smart enough for that. My mom knows I'm stupid, right? But here's a question. If everything must be explained by the laws of physics and chemistry, help me understand what a moral value is. Does it have mass, occupy space, hold a charge, have a wavelength? Are you catching the dilemma already that they have? Here's another one. How did matter and energy and time and chance result in a set of objective moral values? Did the Big Bang really spew forth love your enemy? Yes, so help me to understand that. Do you catch what they're saying? This, all these things, the Big Bang, you know, all of the molecules, when that exploded in the Big Bang, there was a whisper going with it, love your enemy. It's not very logical, is it? Do you see even asking a question how it can challenge? But people are buying into it. And yeah, some of the smarter people have answers to it. But the common person, when you ask them some of these questions, they want to have an answer, and it creates a dissonance on their hearts. And if we can do it with gentleness and respect, let me give you the last question. What makes your moral standard more subjective, opinion or personal preference? It's a subtle way that gets right to decision. Who decides what's moral? If you're saying it's gone through evolution, who gets a right to decide that? Why can't I just ignore it? Won't the end be the same, the death and the grave, either way? Now, your brains are probably fried at this point. I don't know. I need to end. Church family, the power of questions is a skill that we must learn to be prepared to give a defense for the hope that is within us because of Jesus. And here's the deal. When Christians say that I don't want you to have a corner on truth, there's an answer to that. With gentleness and respect, can you sit down? Let's have a cup of coffee and talk about where does truth come from? How do you define what's good and what's bad? And you chip away at their heart. And if the Holy Spirit is softening their heart, they will begin to see the lies that they begin to believe, that they've been believing. Then who gets to define what loving is? Who gets to define what reasonable is? And you can just, you don't have to shout at them. You just say, here's what I believe. I believe that God is the one that transcends, that he is truth. He defines what's true. He defines what's loving. And then we can bear witness and say, and I'm a follower of Christ. And the truth comes from the scriptures. And we're going to go here next week. How do you deal with this? But maybe you're visiting today. I don't know. Or you're here today. And you listen to this stuff and you're going, And here's what I would say to you. We believe that there's a God who loves us profoundly and wants to break through our lives and give us hope. So when we walk out of this place, when we walk through the week, that we are certain that this life is, there's more to this life than just the stuff that's happening, and there's an eternity out there that he's inviting us to. And I would tell this to you, if you don't know him, he's inviting you to a place where you can have hope for eternity. Matter of fact, here's, look at this, John 14:6. Jesus said to him, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but through me." See, the one that's called truth is looking and inviting all of us to walk with him and to live lives that we're helping other people come to that place where they can have hope. So we can be confident as we walk out of here this week that God is one that loves us. He is a transcendent God. He puts the rules. He says what's right and wrong, but he does it because he loves us, not to punish us. Because he wants us to live life to the fullest as we walk with him. So if you're here today and you don't know him, you've never committed your life to him, would you, my phone number's on there, you can email, text me, stop, grab me after the service. I would love to ask if you want to ask questions or to go farther. But let's just stand and pray.